Welcome to another edition of the Books and Culture podcast with John Wilson, who is the editor of Books and Culture, and I'm Stan Guthrie. What's on tap today, John?
Stan, when I tell you the title of this book, you're probably going to inwardly groan. You won't do it outwardly, but
I might do it outwardly.
It's The Sound Studies Reader, edited by Jonathan Stern and published by Rutledge.
Now that looks like something straight out of the 60s, some kind of stereo my parents may have had in their den back when I was a little kid.
On the cover there? Yeah. Well, I think that I doubt if they had a stereo that was quite that powerful. I admit that the title may sound like something of very narrow academic interest, but that's not true. In fact, I'm actually not going to talk a lot about the individual contents of this book. I'm going to say that if you are in theology, you should get this book. If you're in literary study, you should get this book. There are lots of different fields that it applies to. And the name Sound Studies sounds kind of clumsy and ugly, but it's about the nature of sound in human experience from many different perspectives. So that, for instance, if you look down the auditory dimension, all right, that's one piece. Noise, the political economy of music. Three listening modes. Cassette sermons, oral modernities, and the Islamic revival in Cairo.
That's quite eclectic, isn't it?
And that's just a tiny sample of what's in here. I will now go back about 40 years to would have been either the fall of 1968 or the spring of 1969. And it was my junior year in college. I had transferred for that year to Westmont College in Santa Barbara. And I was reading a scholar named Hugh Kenner, who I've mentioned to you before, and someone I learned more from than from any other single person. I hadn't been reading him for very long, but I had already discovered that when he mentioned something, I should follow up on it. And a couple of times he had mentioned someone named Walter Ong, O-N-G. And by the way, for a long time, seeing that last name, I assumed that he was Chinese. Turned out it's an old English name. But okay. And Ong was a Jesuit scholar. He had recently published a book called The Presence of the Word. He'd already published several other books, and he went on to publish many more. But I believe it was in 1967, just a year or two earlier, that Yale University Press had published this book, The Presence of the Word. And that was one of those few books. Aren't there many books that you read that just change your way of understanding the world? But that was one of those books for me. And he talked about what he called the sensorium and the way in which we understand the world and perceive the world in different ways through our different senses. And that at any given place and time in human history, the weight given to what we take in from one sense and the way that we process things is different from what it might be at another time and place. That in itself was a revelation to me. I'd never thought about that. I'd never heard anyone say anything like that. But particularly one aspect of his book that struck home was the emphasis on the world of sound and how there was a time, very long period in the evolution of human culture when there was no writing. And then there was a very long time when writing was restricted to very few purposes and only a small number of people with special training were able to write. And for the most part, what was transmitted in such cultures, which he called primary oral cultures, was transmitted by sound. It has implications for people studying the Gospels. And there's some very interesting work that's been done in the decades since on looking at the Gospels from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. But that book set me off on a course of reading, which continues to this day. And one of the things that's exciting is to see how the work that Ong and some others were doing has turned into a very vigorous field of scholarship of its own. And especially, this is something that's been happening, as I said, over the period of decades. But in the last, let's say, roughly 10 years or a little more, the field has absolutely exploded. And that's why you have something like this, which was just published by Rutledge, which both samples some work that has been done relatively recently by people who are self-consciously working in this field. And then it also draws some earlier work that bears on these same subjects by people who were writing before there was any such self-consciously formed area of study.
And so are we in an age particularly suited to the auditory?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say that all of the senses are important, but there's one sense that tends to dominate very clearly in the way that we describe the world and the metaphors that we use for understanding, and that's the visual. I mentioned to you relatively recently spending some time in Texas with this very interesting brain scientist, John Medina, and he has in his book, Brain Rules, he has a section on how the visual trumps the other senses in the way that the brain processes the world. And so it's not just arbitrary that there's so much emphasis on vision, but it's one thing to say, all right, vision rules in the way that we perceive and make sense of the world. It's one thing to say that, and then it's another thing to allow that one particular way of seeing and understanding, you know, I notice I use the word seeing, with to dominate to the exclusion of the others. And once you start listening, let's say, as well as seeing, you encounter many things that you understand in a new light. Jeremy Begbie, the theologian and also musician, has written some wonderful books, including Theology, Music, and Time, on this theme. I do want to say one thing about this book, which, again, I strongly recommend to a wide range of readers. While the subjects that are touched on are wonderfully diverse, as we found just in that one little sampling, it's heavily weighted towards certain ideological presuppositions. And on the other hand, it's seriously deficient in its understanding of theological understandings of sound. To give you just one example of that, Ong is barely mentioned in the book, by the way, but in the introduction to the last section, one of the last sections, Voices, the editor says, voices are among the most personalized and most naturalized forms of subjective self-expression. Speakers and auditors routinely treat them as the stuff of consciousness. This goes back to the longstanding equivalence between voice and spirit in some Christian spiritualisms. And you're saying, Christian spiritualisms? What is he talking about there? And then in the next paragraph, this is the only reference to Ong in the entire text. Drawing from vocabularies and epistemologies of Christian spiritualism, Marshall McLuhan and Walter Ong based an entire psychosocial theory of orality around ideas of the voice as presence and so on. And then there's this very dismissive reference to their work. But their voice was a universal one, unraced, ungendered, and so on. They're mentioned just very briefly and then consigned to the dustbin. And it's very telling, that use of the word spiritualism. It's sort of like people who refer, we've seen this many times, people refer to evangelicals as evangelists, you know, scholars, people with PhDs. And a very familiar sign of contempt is when someone doesn't even bother to learn the most basic vocabulary of the group that you are discussing. So I think that that's too bad. On the other hand, there's an enormous wealth, and this is the kind of book that very few people will read from beginning to end, no matter what their purpose is. But there are many, many different ways that you can enter, and those, the essays and excerpts that are gathered here, point you in countless different directions, so that I think that there could be very few readers who found the subject at all enticing who wouldn't profit greatly.
Good words. Hugh has ears to hear. Let him hear.
Thanks, John. Amen.